This is the Beat Your Genes podcast. My name is Nate G. I've created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle and Dr. Jen Hong, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle and Dr. Hawk analyze and explain the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many more. We broadcast live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which means you can call us during a show and ask a question. The U.S. number is 657-383-0751. Or you can send us a question through the website, www.beatyourgenes.org. All right, good evening, everybody. It's Nate G here, along with Dr. Doug Lyle and Dr. Jen Hawk with the Beat Your Genes podcast. Dr. Lyle is here with us. Dr. Hawk is taking the evening off, so we have Dr. Lyle. How are you doing this evening, Dr. Lyle?
Very good. It's like old times, Nathan.
I was going to say, it's been a while. It's been a while. Yeah. Just the two of us.
You got it.
All right. Well,
all right.
As promised, want to do a little stats recap for the coronavirus and this COVID-19 going on. Before we do, Dr. Lyle, I wanted to get a comment from you. In a county in New York, right near Long Island, there is Lori Curran gave a press conference. This was yesterday. And I just want to mention they have now started to reopen certain parts of the county. And so now they have rolled out these very detailed instructions about what to do when you're on the tennis courts. Listen in here.
Huh.
Unless they're from the same household, has to bring their own tennis balls so that you don't touch other people's tennis balls with your hands. You can kick their balls, but you can't touch them. I'm going to blush. Sorry. Of course, if you're playing with someone in your household, you can touch those tennis balls. To avoid confusion between whose balls are whose, you can use a marker, like a Sharpie, to mark out, to put an X or put someone's initials on them.
Dr. Lyle, I feel as though when the officials start telling us how to take care of each other's balls, it's very, very difficult to take a pandemic seriously when I start hearing that.
Who was this? The mayor or something?
Yeah, Lori Curran. She's the one of the executives in the city, of Nassau County.
Got it.
In New York.
Got it. Well, sounds like she's a tennis pro. So she's trying to give very specific advice. Oh my! All right. Well, are we gonna let's talk just a little bit about just for entertainment about where Corona is at? I haven't been paying super close attention. My mind sort of just drifts away from it more these days. However, one fact is coming to light that is it's both sad and it's reassuring. And we've been here before, but apparently, it's looking like somewhere between 40 and 50% of all deaths are taking place in long-term care facilities in the United States. I've worked in nursing homes, folks, and so they are very, they're very sad places to be. It's very heart-wrenching to be around these elderly folks that are so compromised in either mental function or physical function or both. And so the thought that, you know, this virus will work its way through a nursing home, and it looked by some accounts, this won't be perfect because this was just one sample, but I think in one set of data, there was about something like somewhere between 3,000 and 4,000 cases that went through nursing homes and about 500 deaths. So it was about somewhere on the order of, I don't know, maybe 15 or 20% of the people in a nursing home when the virus goes through there will die, which is just, you know, just an awful fear-inducing, you know, tragedy that takes place. And so, however, the other, I mean, so obviously something that comes to mind is that, Yeah, a great deal of human intelligence and effort needs to go into figuring out how to see to it that this happens far less than it's been happening. Apparently, it's been rampant, not just in the United States, but in other places in Europe, et cetera, where we have just not had good protocols and a good understanding about how to manage something like this. The silver lining part of this is obviously that you can look at half of the fatalities and realize that it's clear that they're not just elderly people, but they're elderly people in serious trouble relative to their more functional cohorts in that are living independently out in the world. So there's apparently about 5 million people living in these kinds of facilities in the United States, and we've lost about 50,000 of them, apparently. So it's 1%, which is, you know, it's a huge number of people. But the big problem is it's a pretty big percentage of the people that have been infected, obviously. And these are like petri dishes. These are places where it's very easy to pass something like this along. The places where I worked, the people didn't have their own rooms. I don't know how common that is, but there was a lot of times just simply a sheet or some kind of a canvas between beds, etc. So you can just imagine what this looks like and how it feels, and then also how helpless the people feel under these circumstances and how helpless they are. However, the silver lining is that once again we're seeing that the virus is not taking massive amounts of life years from human beings. It's taking small amounts of life years, and that's a good thing, obviously. So we can hopefully do better with our protecting our elderly people, but we also have to now look. On a more utilitarian level, as far as I'm concerned, we have to look at the cost benefit of the things that we're doing and trying to analyze how much risk of human life. And when we're not just talking about a number of a yes or no digit, alive or dead, we're talking about how many years of life we are talking about being lost. That to me is the heartless sounding but intelligent analysis of this problem, or really, quite frankly, almost any problem, has to be looked through that lens, particularly when we're talking about massive resources of a society being directed around. It makes sense to try to essentially save as much life as possible. And so that means trying to figure out, you know, where the biggest benefits are, where the biggest vulnerabilities are, and try to be smart about how we direct our resources. In any event, so there's nothing super new about this. I think that there's concern now among people that there's a syndrome, that there's some children that have died of COVID complications. I think the numbers are exceedingly low. I think they're going to remain that way from the look of it, because we believe there's been at least 500,000 children in the United States at least who have been infected. And I think we have a very, very small number of deaths. It's, I believe, less than 20 people under the age of 20 have died of directly of corona. And apparently, a majority of those have had some fairly serious underlying conditions. So, therefore, parents and children themselves, if they're paying attention, can experience some degree of relief just looking at the math of this. So what do we find? You know, we're finding that this is a nasty stressor that is really pretty merciless if you're elderly and you are weak and frail, which many of our elderly people are. And as a result, you know, this is going to this is going to go on for a while, and it may stick with us. But this hopefully will be the worst we'll ever see it, because we were we had the poorest preparation and poorest understanding. So that's the story from here. So we can, when we look at these big numbers, I like to translate the numbers for myself into the amount of life years lost. That to me seems to be something that is worth considering when we're actually looking at the total cost that's involved here. And so we apparently out of the University College London, those folks are thinking that about 2 out of 3 of the people that die of corona would have died in the next 12 months. That is, you know, as we say, it's a human tragedy, but it's also, it puts the fatality numbers in a very different light than when we're staring at the screen and we're seeing the big numbers that we see. So also, I believe that I think there's significant reason to believe that we have a lot of personal control over over just whether or not you're a victim. In other words, your own degree of how well you take care of your own health and what kind of shape you're in, I think is a significant variable in whether or not if you are not an elderly and frail person, or if you're an elderly and you're somewhat frail, but you're still with it enough to be in control of what it is that you eat and where it is that you live, et cetera, then, you know, pay attention, because your odds of surviving corona are very high in that instance, but they'll be higher if you do a better job of diet and lifestyle issues and make sure you take care of yourself, just as we all would, you know, aiming at an optimum or near optimum health strategies. All right.
Yeah, as a patient mm-hmm. here at Fasting Escape told me, he mm-hmm. said his priority at this point is to flatten his own curve.
Yes. Yes. The one. Yeah, go ahead.
No, I was going to change topics. So if you had something about this.
No, I did have something else to say about this. And that's that I think there's a curious sociological phenomenon that's taking place here, sort of independent of the political, you know, the sort of political issues that are surrounding the coronavirus. And that is Jen Hawk would call this, I think, mission creep, that she says this goes on in corporations and political systems all the time, apparently. But that's a major concept. But that's where you go over to look for Saddam Hussein, and pretty soon you're doing a whole lot more stuff, and it's way more expensive. But similarly, psychology has noted that there's tendencies of humans to dislike incomplete pictures. They don't like to start things and then stop them in the middle. And so these are well-known effects, some of the, you know, famous effects in the history of psychology that have been studied. And this, I call it open loops. So people don't like open loops. It makes them uncomfortable. And so this, I think, has happened to many of our political leaders, as well as the society in general. There's been a lot of this, where it's like this started out with a obviously great fear, leading to very significant prescriptions for how it is that we're going to try to manage it. The essentially bracing for a tidal wave and understanding that a tidal wave could be catastrophic in many directions, and primarily that the health system could be completely overwhelmed, and all kinds of needed medical care for all kinds of other people could get pushed aside, and we could be in trouble of losing an awful lot of life as an ancillary, you know, collateral damage to the coronavirus. And so obviously the right thing to do, if you're trying to think this through, is to flatten the curve. And that was a term that got bandied about and was very much the goal of what it is that we were up to. Then we got Jen Hawk's mission creep. And I will argue there's certainly political left and right ramifications that creep in behind this. But I think also, from my own sense of this, is that there's also this natural human tendency to, once you get in the middle of something, you want to finish it. You don't want to walk away half done. So you can look at your messy house and just sit there and not want to deal with it. But once you start dealing with it, you want to keep going because you want to finish it. And this in, you know, this, like I said, this has been subject of untold psychological experiments for 80 years. And so I think that's partly when I see some of the tenacity of some of the political leadership, some of it I think has to do with that. Like, no, they don't want to let things get back to normal until every case is gone. And I, you know, an intelligent epidemiologist looks at this and says, you're out of your mind. You have no idea what you're talking about. This is ludicrous. But it's not actually emotionally ludicrous to humans per se. And I think that that's a very interesting phenomenon that's going on. And it's banging up against the other side of it, which is other human beings running the CB, you know, outside of that feeling of responsibility or just feeling of general fear and following those directions or having different political inclinations. In other words, there's other people that are bucking against that. And it gets to be potentially fairly heated debate. And but I think that part of the desires of some of the leadership has, you know, wherever you are, whatever state you're in or whatever the federal part of the, it doesn't matter who we're talking about. Anybody that's in a position to be calling some shots on how a community would manage their situation, some of the reason for the heavy hand has to do with, well, we're halfway in, let's finish it. And that is something that I actually haven't heard of discussion about this phenomenon. I've heard it, you know, the political arguments on all sides, but the sort of carnal level fear and desire is, well, we're in this far, let's just finish it. And I think that's I think that the society will eventually have to push back against that, which they of course will. And so that will come apart. And I think that some of the officials' desires will wind up being tested in courts because they will feel like, no, I've got to do the right thing here. And the right thing is to keep my clenched fist around this situation. And we want to stamp it out. And I think, of course, that they're not going to be able to do that. So it's an interesting, I wasn't planning on talking about this at all. But I've had a few other thoughts about this, which is that I like to, when I'm trying to solve problems and think things through, I like to try to move parameters around in my imagination. I think it's a useful way to sometimes look at problems from diverse angles and see if the problem is a categorical problem where there's either a right way or wrong way, or whether it's a parametric problem where, in fact, something that's right at 30% is wrong at 40%. And so it's a useful thing to, if you're not sure, move the 30% to 80% and then see what it looks like to you. And so I thought about this, and I thought about that I believe that the courts will wind up essentially rejecting heavy-handed moves by governors and mayors and so on and so forth, that they give them some latitude and then they're going to end that latitude. And we might say, well, ooh, now, is that the right decision? And I think it is the right decision in this case. However, I thought to myself, is it a right decision in principle? And the answer is, no, not necessarily. What if we had a virus that was five times more lethal than this? And it was not just five times more lethal, but it was more capricious. And it was picking off children. It was picking off 25-year-olds just coming out of college, grad school. And it's like, uh-oh, what if it was a lot worse? And what if what seemed to be reasonably called for until we knew what to do or what we were going to do was to have very draconian lockdowns? Okay, then what would the judges say? And I think the answer is, I think this becomes an extremely interesting legal question at that point. And we wind up with the legal system essentially trying to figure out, you know, the answer to parametric problems, which is what the legal system often has to do and why they have case law, and they mull it all over. And, you know, essentially you try to figure it out willy-nilly is how this happens. So so I think really this becomes sort of an interesting legal frontier in principle, because I don't think we're set up that well to try to answer these questions, particularly in real time if it's coming at us relatively fast. And so, you know, hopefully we never face Corona times five. And if we do, I think that, of course, you may not get the public pushback that you're getting now. You're getting the public pushback now, folks, because the realities are seeping into people about what the real numbers mean for them. And they're understanding that their risk levels are actually very low. And they're understanding that they are willing to take those risks. And they are willing to put you and your family and your elderly people at risk. And the society, given the level of risk that's involved, that's a completely reasonable position. So, in other words, the society at this point would say, well, if you want to stay home and you have the resources to stay home and you don't want to shake anybody's hand and you don't want to go to a restaurant and you want to remain as protected as possible because you're terribly afraid of this, then you're free to do so. There's nothing to stop you. But you can't stop me from taking my risks. So up to now, what we're seeing is that position, you know, is just starting to now emerge in America. And that's a legitimate position based on the level of the threats of the life risks that we see and the life risks that we each carry to each other with respect to the lethality of this virus. That could be different under different circumstances. And there might have to be interesting or, you know, dramatic and terrible legal questions to be pondered at some future date. And we, you know, I hope I don't have to ever see it. So anyway, those are just some of my random thoughts about that.
No, they're excellent, Dr. Lyle. And it keeps it in context because I was thinking about this as I was listening to some more of the stats that you were saying in previous shows and previous videos that you've done. And I was thinking and saying the average person is average extroversion introversion. And so I looked it up. I don't know if it's verified, so I didn't really spend a lot of time looking at it. But the average person apparently knows 600 people. So if the infection rate is 10%, 20%, whatever the figure, you know, the different counties will have. So the average person is supposed to know if this thing was, you know, the average person is supposed to know, you know, 60 to 120 people that are going to, that have been tested positive for this thing, or if they haven't, that they are. And so if it's a, you know, it's the one that we feared 5% killer, then people should, they should know, you know, at least 3 to 6 people that have died of this thing. But people, I mean, as far as my social circle, I'm kind of average in terms of extroversion, introversion. I don't know anybody. Like my friends don't know very many people. So just by the smell test, it doesn't.
Yes.
You know, I guess that's the algorithms going on.
That's exactly the algorithms going on. People are, human beings are not designed to do complex mathematics. They're not even designed to do statistical, you know, descriptive statistics in large numbers. They're just not built to do it. They're built to make their decisions based on the echoes that they hear from their village and what their village seems to be thinking. And so our current society has been inundated with terrifying news from the media, who's obviously, as Jen would say, has perverse incentives for keeping you on the edge of your seat and afraid. And this isn't to say that the media has not been a generator of constant updates of information. In other words, the media process has been doing its job to some degree, but it's also done something else that media will do, which is to try to make money. They're mission creep. I mean, they're trying to make money. They're a business person.
As they
so
should.
Think of the media as a pizza parlor, a bunch of pizza parlors. Okay. They're all selling their pizzas. And so it turns out that what sells mostly is, oh my God, we got to tell you the latest thing you need to be terrified of. So that that is starting to wear out. And it's worn out its welcome on a significant percentage of people who at first you have to listen and you pause and you think and you know that you don't know. But if enough people are essentially semi-unanimous saying that you're in serious trouble, then you better be careful. Only a fool doesn't pause and pay attention. However, as you say, the most important algorithms become what is my real life personal experience? And so in my real life personal experience now, a couple months into this, I've known, I don't know, 7 or 8 or 10 people that have been infected that knew it. And I know a person who had an elderly relative die, an elderly, just the kind of an individual that we would expect to die. And so I didn't catch anybody in my circle that was a surprise. Nobody that was 68 died. Nobody that was 74 died. The person that died was over 80 and in poor health. And so I don't know that many people, being an introvert, but I'm connected up enough that my circle probably of that I would have heard and would have known. Oh, I do know about a 75-year-old that was in the hospital and in trouble and on a ventilator and then recovered. So of the sort of 50 people somehow fairly closely connected to me, we have one fatality just where we would have expected it in the bell curve. We had another near fatality just where we would have expected it, or pretty close. And that's it, okay? And we had some people that were sick and told me that it was nasty, okay? And that was like the worst flu they ever had. So I got the warning, you know, from my village that, hey, this was no day at the beach. And so that led me to be personally more fastidious and a little more careful than I would have been. However, I think you're absolutely right, Nathan, that there's Stone Age algorithms running the show, and it's starting to push back against the fear as it reasonably would. And now we watch both the political and personality and honest to goodness financial interests of all different individuals as they swirl around, and the various little governmental systems try to sort it out. Mm-hmm. So they will. And we're seeing them sorted out now. And this, I always, one of my very favorite passages or very favorite visual pictures from The Selfish Gene was Richard Dawkins talking about all the penguins that line themselves up on the edge of the ice, wanting to go in the water to get the fish, but they have to be worried about the sea leopards that live down there. They're these terrifying mammals that kill penguins. And so they're huddling very close, and every once in a while they'll bump into each other and bump somebody in the water, and then they'll all look and see whether or not he gets eaten. And this is reminiscent of what's happening with the politicians all around the country. Somebody gets bumped in the water or chooses to jump in the water and loosen their controls, and then they get to see what happens, and all the other penguins get to watch. And that's what we're going to see. We're going to see penguins watching other penguins, and we will know an awful lot. And the landscape of control is going to change dramatically here in the next 4 to 6 weeks.
Yeah, and it didn't help the government's case when maybe it was last week or so, Ferguson's original model from the Imperial College of London, apparently they tried to recreate the numbers that that everybody was basing all these lockdowns with on, and mm-hmm. they tried to recreate it and found out that his model was like somehow broken. They couldn't recreate it at all. There's some random thing that it spit out. So that didn't, I don't think it helped things.
Strange. Yeah. I mean, I think that whatever it is that they were thinking had some rationale. Mm-hmm. And I think other very bright minds were saying, I don't think he's right. Okay. And I'm pretty sure he's wrong, and I'm pretty sure he's pretty badly wrong. And it turns out that it's a mess. And so when there's a scary thing, you're going to see two different opposing opinions, and you're going to see a bell curve in between. And so that's what we got with coronavirus. And we're finding that the bell curve in terms of the how lethal it is, how dangerous it is, leans significantly towards the more benign interpretation, not all the way over there. Okay. And however, the societal impact and how much consternation this causes, and therefore how much care that governments have to utilize and politicians have to utilize in making their decisions, and how you have this little Zeigarnik effect, open loop process going on, that I think, as well as a bunch of other things. I think that it's a quite a bit bigger social, political, financial mess than I ever envisioned. I did not anticipate what it is that I'm seeing. But I believed, you know, a couple months ago that life would look awfully normal by the 1st of July. I believe that's still true, but it's a lot deeper and messier, than I thought it was going to be. And, you know, we're still in for some messy weeks ahead.
Now, one final question on this, I know that a lot of people have said that, and I have heard the argument that one of the arguments to begin open up is that with the lockdown, with the businesses shut down, people may be at increased risk for suicides and other types of deaths. And so now it becomes the ethical problem mm-hmm. of weighing the deaths on one side versus the deaths on the other side. So the question I have is, we've said that the people who are the sickest with coronavirus, who if they get coronavirus, they only have a few more years left to live. So they're essentially going to die anyway. Coronavirus just speeds that process up. So I guess the other question on the other side is if the people would have killed, you know, would have committed suicide because of this, are they on their way anyway without a lockdown? And this is just speeding it up on the other end.
Interesting questions. And I would sort of, I don't think that that's, I mean, the people that may or may not suicide as a result of financial calamities is I don't know. I suppose one would want to weigh in on that, and one could. And that was a beautiful line, by the way, of Brad Pitt's character in The Big Short. And where the two guys, the little guy was dancing because he knew he was going to get rich because he'd figured out how to short the market. And Pitt said, don't dance. You know, people die with every 1% of unemployment, you know, X amount of people die. And by die, I think he was meaning suicide. I'm not sure what else you would die from. So I suppose it's a consideration, but to me, it would be one of many considerations, and it wouldn't be an apples to apples issue there at all. It's a much more multidimensional, multivariate, you know, question as to the cost benefits of what it is that we're doing. Incidentally, it's very unclear about any benefit that have taken place as a result of this, other than the flattening of the curve and therefore not overwhelming health systems. I'm not sure, and a typical epidemiologist would tell you they don't really think that you're saving any lives with respect to the virus. Mm. You may save lives with respect to not overwhelming a health system. So that's the whole point of flattening the curve, is to distribute the deaths so that we don't overwhelm the system. You're not going to stop them from happening. Now, this is where it gets tricky and bizarre for people to try to think clear about this, because you look over to Asia and it looks like they just stopped it.
Okay. Stop keeping track of
so it. It's like, oh, okay, now how was that done? Okay. And if it was done there, should we be doing it? And I think that it can be done with sufficient, unbelievable draconian measures. And those are measures that now that becomes, you talk about a legal test and a test of American ideals and how it is that we're going to live. That becomes a whole different question. I don't think that possibility is on the chessboard for, you know, I don't think it was on the chessboard for most of these societies in Europe, and it wasn't on the chessboard for the United States or Canada. And I don't think it's on the chessboard for Brazil or Mexico or all kinds of other places. The fact that you had some countries in Asia that had sufficient verticality to the political system, and that they could just do that, and that they had enough fear and compliance in the society that they would follow suit. You know, I can't remember. In Japan, I heard something like, oh, well, if you sell a mask on the black market, you're going to get thrown in jail and fined $100,000. I don't know. I don't want, it was something. It was some outlandish penalty that would never fly in a United States court. Okay, so we give our citizens, and we have granted our citizens and our through our history and our psychology, of way more freedom than that. And as a result of that, that that means that the government doesn't have that kind of control. It is a fascinating thing to, we will learn in the months to come, whether or not they were actually successful and they were actually able to choke this, these things by the throat and choke them out. And if they did, they did. And it's like, okay, that's very interesting that you did. At what price? And, you know, and what was the net benefit? And now comes in, you know, if anybody wants to make a case for that at a U.S. Situation, you would have to then, again, do the total accounting that's involved. You know, how much of how many people's lives do you want to disrail? And how many people do you want to essentially bankrupt so that they can't buy new brakes for their car and they don't, and then they have auto accidents? You know, how many relationships are torn apart behind the financial disruption? How many dreams die? And what did we do? You know, why did we do this in exchange for specifically what? And so that's why I won't mind looking at very careful academic level statistical analysis of what did we get and what did we give up for it? You know, what was the exchange and was it a good one? And I think that we're going to find that the exchange from every day past May the 1st was probably pretty badly in the red, I think is what we're going to find. I think that computing in the amount of uncertainty that we had through April, that we weren't quite sure what we were dealing with, and not enough people knew, and we didn't have a great enough understanding, that it probably made a lot of sense to be overreacting, very conservative, cross your fingers, flatten the curve, and try to get prepared. I think that makes a lot of sense. Now that we sit with greater information and a greater understanding, I think that it makes sense that what we're seeing around the country in many municipalities is an opening up, and opening up slow, the penguins watching each other in the water. And I think that I think we're in the red now, but not badly. In other words, I think that I think it's wise to kind of do things halfway the way we're doing them. And we've got distributed decision making all over the place, so that we've got more conservative, more liberal, more wild, more careful kinds of personalities in these different municipalities. But they're all watching each other. And so I don't, like Garcetti in Los Angeles is obviously very anxious guy, very worried, doesn't want to have the big loser pinned on his forehead. But he's now going to get to watch other governors, other states, and other municipalities who are more relaxed than he is and more confident. And he's going to be able to watch what happens to them. And then he's going to see that it's unlikely that any catastrophe is brewing, and that he can now safely move towards relaxing control. So I think that to me, if you're in Los Angeles and you have an understanding that you believe that this is a mistake to be as controlling as he is right now, then you're very, very frustrated and you're ready to call out the new revolution.
I know a few friends.
You know, you're all bent out of shape.
They sent me a message. We're going to the Capitol at high noon on Monday or whatever the day they're going. They're watching Westerns and getting excited.
This is not the Vietnam War. This is not your government, you know, doing some terrible thing to you that we have to call to arms, and that we got to fight, you know, street fighting, man. You know, this is not what this is. This is different people, different personalities looking at the problem in fear. And some a little more bold than others, and in a little bit better situation than others, possibly more confidence and less downside risk to their careers or just their own intuitions. And so you're going to find a whole bunch of different moving parts. And 30 days from now, as you're expected in the first day of class in the first grade, that some kids are more bold and they are ready to raise their hand for the teacher, and other kids at the back of the class can't even squeak out their names, okay, because of their anxiety. And so we find, though, that at the end of the first two or three weeks, even the little shy one at the back will call out her name when they're asked, you know. it just took a little while. And I think that a little while now is, you know, the month of May and into mm-hmm. part of June.
And, you know, for me to be fair to these governors that, I get a little angst over is I wouldn't want to be in their position. So I think they're, you know.
Yeah. I had somebody send me a sort of flaming email that I think she took issue with the fact that I've complimented the world's governments and people. And she took that as a big endorsement of Trump and was just all bent out of shape with me. And what anybody thinks of Trump or not, or Garcetti or not, or Gavin Newsom or not, or DeSantis in Florida or not, the truth of the matter is these are all individuals that are scrambling like hell not to look bad, not be idiots, not piss people off, and they're trying to do the right thing. The fact that they have different information, different personalities, somewhat different political agendas, that's all, hey, such is life. You know, so what? The truth is that I look back at humanity trying to communicate like crazy. Now, the rage at China that they may have covered things up and pretended that it wasn't as bad. It's like, really? I mean, you could be really mad at them for doing that, but could you blame them for crying out loud? I mean, if I knock over my aunt's favorite vase and, you know, and there's a dog around, I'm creeping out of there and I'm going to pretend like the dog.
This podcast is not sponsored by the Communist Chinese Party, I promise.
No. Absolutely not. So, I mean, I can, there's all these curious ideas about suing them. I don't know. This is all for other people to think about. But I look at human beings in general, and I look at the communication and cooperation and concern, you know, within this country for our own people and our curiosity and interest and worry about people elsewhere. And our fascination with how different places are trying to handle it and trying to learn, and everybody's feverishly, you know, trying to figure and learn and try to demonstrate that they think they've got the answer. It's like, hey, it's all fine to me. And so I don't really have heavy-handed criticism really for I don't know enough about. I'm sure there's some individuals out there that if I knew what they were doing in their position, that I would be like thoroughly disgusted, maybe. I don't even know of a single case about that. I know that there's people that I would disagree with and I would debate them and I would try to convince them of my position that my position might be different than theirs. But I don't know anybody that I've disgusted with. That I don't know, except one guy. All right. So I was talking to a doctor friend of mine and I said, hey, listen, there's this really good news. It looks like this group, you know, may have a vaccine, which would be fabulous. And they talked about their eight initial people and that they had good results. And it looks like they're going to be scaling up for a bigger test. And I was very happy about this. It's like, I have not been expecting that we would see a vaccine or any serious promise of a vaccine anytime soon. I mean, vaccines are difficult and chancy. I'm amused when they talk about how, well, we're going to get ready to scale up, you know, for millions of things. That's a pie in the sky talk. Like, we're going to make millions of these things called computers. It's like, well, first figure out how to make one. Okay. So first figure out whether or not you can even figure this thing out. So they had reported that they had some good results. And so I was talking to a doc friend of mine and she hadn't heard about this. So we were pretty happy about it. And then I can't remember what happened. So I went on to line to get some more information to tell her about it. And it says, oh, well, looks like there's bad news on that. And I'm like, oh God, I just heard this good news yesterday. And so it turns out that there's a guy apparently that's the head of the White House task force on the, vaccine. And this guy held a company, or he was founder or some big stockholder, major player in this company that made this announcement on Monday that they had this great results. And it turns out that on Tuesday, a bunch of scientists are saying, wait a second, how come they didn't publish it? Why didn't they show us what the results are? I don't, you know, none of the thing, this is not passing the sniff test. And so major academics are saying, where's the numbers, dude? It turns out on Monday, their stock soared way up. The whole stock market lifted. And it turns out that our little friend that's the head of the White House task force on the vaccine sold out 12 million of his shares.
Yeah, speaking of that movie, Big Short.
Yeah, and totally speaking, like that, it's so bad. I have never seen a news report so fast to put a blazing 10,000 watt eyeball, you know, on a specific individual for pulling a stunt like this. I have no idea if this is actually what went down, but it looks, folks, really bad. That is the ultimate, what they call pump and dump on Wall Street. Yeah, we have a brand new virus that's going to save the world. And oh, by the way, while we're announcing this bogus result, probably, I'm selling all my stock. So, yeah, it's an amazing carousel of drama. And we'll just have to keep learning more and you know, slowly and surely moving in a good direction, as I think we generally are.
Well, as Rahm Emanuel says, never let a good crisis go to waste, apparently. I guess that's...
Yeah, this guy read that. Yeah. He read that very carefully.
Mayor of, yeah, former mayor of Chicago, so it's no surprise there. But
ah, there you go. Very yeah. good.
All right. Well, all right. Well, we promised the listeners a couple minutes on coronavirus, and we wound out on a little bit more than that, which I'm totally fine with. I thought that was really a lot of fun.
Why not?
We did have some questions. Okay.
We promise next week.
Next week. Yeah, we have some questions next week on the pleasure trap, on the difference yeah. between drug usage versus the pleasure trap in foods, addictive properties. Yeah. So looking forward to hearing more from you, Dr. Lyle, about that. And Dr. Lyle, you know, hopefully the prediction comes true and that this will all settle down very soon, hopefully sooner rather than later.
Yeah.
But thank you so much for coming on. Dr. Lyle, we miss you, just me and you. Not that we have anything against Dr. Hawk, but it's a lot of fun to have you on.
It's all cool. We'll do this now and then, and you and Jen can do it solo now and then. I think it's just good to change it up. It's fun.
Absolutely. Well, Dr. Lyle, have a wonderful, wonderful night, and we'll talk to you next show.
Terrific. Thank you, Nathan. See you next week.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G., Dr. Lyle, and Dr. Hawk with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.